Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
You're talking about limiting first fills. You're talking about really taking advantage of the data and facts that we understand on how someone gets addicted. When it goes past 5 days or 6 days, that's when the incidence of addiction skyrocket.
We're here in part because of well-meaning policy that was not well thought out. Making pain a vital sign and then creative marketing by drug companies created this problem. In the case of opiate management, I think that there have been a contribution to our crisis of people who were not well enough trained in these drugs, did not have continuing medical education, and quite frankly, didn't see what they were creating.
For too long, the debate in this state on education has been dominated by negative voices and by organizations and entities that see some kind of political advantage in tearing down our teachers and our schools. We're just not going to stand for that anymore.
I think there's a variety of things that we can do, and I'd like to talk to other experts on that. But just like pension reform, I did it, and moving forward, we changed it so that it was sustainable. I think we need to do the same with entitlement reforms.
And joining us to talk about the opioid special session and a new campaign to talk up Arizona's education system, our former legislative leader and former member of the Board of Regents, Chris Hurstam, and Marcus Dellartino, partner at the firm First Strategic. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
In a moment, we're going to talk with Will Humble, former state health director, about the opioid special session. But first, I want to get your take. Marcus, let me start with you. Perspective on the opioid special session. Was it a success? Was this really, I know everything was unanimous, was this as bipartisan as it felt?
It really was. And kudos to the governor and kudos to Democrat leadership who worked very well together, everybody, on this specific issue. And I hopefully it's a sign of things to come. But I know everybody was very pleased. And frankly, they worked very hard on it.
Chris, how political was it ultimately?
Oh, I think, as Marcus said, it was an unusual bipartisan effort. Once the Democrats got the governor to commit to $10 million in addiction money for the uninsured or underinsured, they were on board and didn't really question anything. Actually, the only hesitation came from Republicans that were hearing from some of their doctors in their district and so forth and wondering about laws that maybe they didn't particularly care for. But those were all – the answer there was we can always – update those laws later. A lot of the program doesn't even go into effect till 2019. So eventually the governor got the Republicans in line and not one no vote. That is very rare. But it's a crisis situation, as I'm sure we'll hear from Will Humble in a moment. And it was nice to see them work together for a health issue that everybody could agree on.
Do either of you think that that spirit of bipartisanship can last or trickle into other issues? Or now that the special session is over, are we back to the typical fights at the Capitol?
In large part, you're going to see the typical fights. But I think that the governor is working overtime to – if we could recreate that on the education package that he's looking to put together in this budget, it would be a true miracle and I think a hats-off moment to both legislative leadership and the governor. And I think that that's what they're certainly trying to work towards. But in large part, you're not going to see that on every single issue.
Yeah, I would agree. It would take a miracle. It's an election year and enjoy the bipartisan flavor as long as you can because probably starting next week, it heats up again politically.
And Chris, is this how special sessions are supposed to go? You're supposed to say, all right, we're going to get in here. We have specific things to accomplish, and we want to do it in less than a week.
Yes, that's always the best way. And it's always the executive, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, that puts the package together. They consult in advance with both parties. They get input from the minority. Here we saw the budget component that once the Democrats and the governor agreed with, the thing went through very quickly. It would be nice to see them do that putting the state budget together and getting the Democratic priorities as well as the Republican priorities and coming to the middle and compromise. That's the way it used to be done, believe me, in the old days when I was in the legislature, and we haven't seen that in many years now. But a special session is supposed to be slam dunk. You do it in a week and you get it done, and the governor and the Democrats got it done.
That's Chris Hurstam. Also here for our Friday newscap is Marcus Dellartino. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. Now for another perspective on the special legislative session about opioids is Will Humble, former state health director, currently executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Will, good morning.
Morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us, of course. So let's talk about some of what you made of this session. One thing that was key going in for a lot of people was the Good Samaritan provision. Why is that important? And overall, what difference could it make?
So the Good Samaritan component is, I mean, it's there were lots of really good things about this bill, one of which was the Good Samaritan component. And essentially what that does is provide some protection for people that when they're in the presence of somebody who's having an overdose of an illegal substance, as it until now or until this law takes effect, you know, the people that are in there with that illegal substance with that person who's having a medical crisis are at risk of prosecution because they're using an illegal substance. This provides a way for people to call 911 and feel comfortable that they're not going to get busted and convicted for having, you know, an illegal substance in their presence. So it's a good emergency response component as part of this bill. But overall, I would say my main impression is, just like the other speakers were saying, it was really refreshing to see public policy being made in such a thoughtful way. I mean, you know, this all started several months ago with good public health surveillance. ADHS did a nice literature review, looked at other best practices in other states, got stakeholder input, and in the end, you can see the result is bipartisan support for something that's really important. It's just really refreshing to see public policy being made this way.
Will, there were some concerns raised about a few issues, one being requirements on what physicians could and could not prescribe, for how long and dosages, and also some concerns about maybe some costs that physicians, especially in some of the more rural counties, would have to incur, especially in relation to electronic prescriptions as opposed to paper ones. How worrisome should those issues be?
Well, you know, I think if you read the details of the law, you'll see that there were actually, the provisions were put into the act to provide mechanisms to alleviate those kinds of concerns. But overall, you know, the bottom line is we've got to make some changes. People are dying. And when you change people's behavior and you ask them by law to do things differently, there's going to be some people that give pushback. Some of that is like with the electronic prescribing. Yes, there's a financial investment that needs to be made. But, you know, guess what? E-prescribing isn't just good for the opioid epidemic. It's good across the board. But, yes, I mean, recognizing there's going to need to be some financial investment on that side. But overall, you know, for people that are currently on opioids for chronic pain that are above that 90 equivalent threshold, there's mechanisms for those people to be able to come down to a lower level. And also for, you know, the current prescribing physicians for that patient to have consultations with pain physicians. So I think, you know, the mechanisms are in place to provide protections for those kinds of concerns. I really believe that.
Will, finally, one of my favorite words is a dull word called logistics, and I wanted to know about why we're in January of 2018. So why are we waiting till 2019, at least for some of these provisions to go into effect?
I think some of the provisions actually need a lot of planning and implementation time, both with, like you were talking about, you know, physician practices, the changes that need to happen with prescribing guidelines. There's regulations that need to change, policies and procedures within facilities. Quite honestly, you've got to educate the physicians about what the new requirements are. You know, they're busy in practices seeing patients every day, and now they've got to take the time to understand what this new policy is, what the new expectations are. So I think to do things I've always been a believer in making sure that you have adequate implementation time. I'd much rather take things at a methodical pace and get it done right the first time than to go too fast and have a lot of confusion. That kind of implementation and those kinds of logistics are, I've seen them cause problems all the time. Better to be thoughtful and get it right by taking the time to do it properly.
That is Will Humble, former state health director, currently executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Will, always good to talk with you. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Bye.
And back in studio with Chris Hurstam and Marcus Dellartino. Guys, we heard Will Humble talking about taking the time to implement some of these things and make sure that we get it right. Do either of you think that this will be the last word, at least for the time being, on opioids? Do you foresee lawmakers or the state health department or maybe Governor Ducey by executive order having to go in and do something else in the near future?
Oh, I think that's very likely. And in fact, that was the defense of the package as it went through the system this week, was that we know that it's going to have to be worked out. Rules are going to have to be put in place by the Department of Health Services. The rulemaking ability is there. And, you know, and why not? This is a crisis. It's ongoing. And if you find new ways to utilize the laws that they have put into place, so be it. So I think everybody expects it to transform as time goes by.
And what I, you know, what I think is partially fascinating about this is on the federal level, there's a task force. You know, it's got Chris Christie, it's got Patrick Kennedy, it's got a bunch of other very smart people on it that is completely stalled and not actually implementing anything. And right now you're watching the states say, hey, we're not waiting for you guys to get your act together. We're going to move and make a difference now. And frankly, it looks to me like the federal government, and it might end up taking cues from the states and how they implement.
Another big item this week, guys, Arizona Education Project. Now, Chris, I'm going to tell people you just rolled your eyes on that. I have to tell them that. But let's we think about the concept behind this, which we've heard from other people before, which is one of the reasons that Arizona Education, maybe even Prop 123, didn't win by as many points as other people expected is because there was negativity surrounding education in Arizona. And this aims to sort of counter that. Do you think that is straight up, or is there other supplemental service?
What is straight up here is this is a front group for a Doug Ducey reelection here in 2018. The timing, it starts in January. They get the money together in December. It's the corporate world. It's Governor Ducey's best friends in the corporate world under the guise of the Arizona Chamber. You know, Mike Bidwell, et cetera. You can go right through the list, a big utility, et cetera. The same players that were there providing money for Ducey 3 years ago that put him over the top easily. They utilize, in this case, it's a different mechanism than a 501c4, which launders the dark money and so forth. This is a, I believe it's a 501c3, and it's in existence to do PR, because the one issue that Ducey fans believe that the governor was vulnerable in was public education funding. The fact that we're still, even with the governor's new expenditures proposed in the next budget, we're still almost $1 billion less into public K-12 than we were a decade ago, and that and the teacher salaries are ridiculously low, and we have shortages. So trying to do this buzz of publicity that says things are improving, things are better, aren't things swell, without ever mentioning the governor by name, it's there to try to mute the criticism that would come to Ducey on public education. And it's frankly probably going to be pretty effective.
Now, briefly, your friend Bob Robb wrote a column this morning saying that there's nothing wrong with this kind of campaign. It doesn't mean that Arizona's education system doesn't need a lot more money, but we should talk up some positive things.
Well, you can talk positive things if you like the status quo. If you want to embrace the status quo and not realize that corporate taxes were reduced ridiculously over the last several years, even during the recession, and surprise, we don't have enough revenue coming in, and therefore we're spending a lot less for public education. If you're okay with that and you just want to incrementally spend a little more over the next 5 years, then fine, then you can support that. But if you want to get back to where we were at least a decade ago and give teachers a good 10-11% raise, then you're going to have to raise some taxes and deal with some big bucks. And the governor, of course, does not want to raise taxes.
Marcus, is there an argument to be made that, yes, Arizona education still needs a lot more, but based on where it was when it started, some amount of progress is worth talking about? Even, I mean, Rome wasn't built in a day. You can't do everything all at once. So maybe we should celebrate where we're at now, understanding that there's still more to do.
Yes, you just stole every talking point from me.
we didn't talk beforehand about this, I promise.
No, you know, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're sort of in the throes of this down at the legislature. And even even some of the Democrats who are, of course, are not do not want to give the governor a win. We are in an election year, and I certainly understand that. Do understand that, look, putting some money in the classroom is definitely a worthwhile cause. We want to do that. We are going to have a debate on what the dollar amount is. And I will tell you that probably, you know, it's very rare that you will find somebody that will agree on what that amount will be. But we are making strides, and not to probably step on your next question, which I'm going to do. But even the superintendent of public instruction this week said, look, we are making strides here. Here are some other things I would like to do to put more money in the classroom. And oddly enough, basically advocated for a tax increase. Remember, Prop 301 reauthorization is coming up. It's widely viewed that that's going to be a large portion of teacher raises. And what she said is, instead of going with the 0.6 that we currently have and continuing that, let's go to a 0.1.
Marcus, you mentioned Prop 301, which is, of course, the sales tax that pays for education. Is there a concern, though, that it seems as though the legislature is going to wait until 2020 to deal with this when the tax expires in 2021? I mean, if they can't get their act together in 2020, that seems like a pretty significant problem.
Yeah, I think there's certainly concern in the business community, and we've seen, you know, some of those people come out and start to talk about what they'd like to go to the ballot with. And that's putting some sort of pressure on the legislature to act. And frankly, we need to have this discussion of whether 0.6 is adequate and we can do everything that we'd like to accomplish with general fund dollars, that the state legislature will do their part, and then the 301 reauthorization will continue us on that path of where we want to get to. Or are we short in some areas and we need to move to a 0.1? And we need to come to agreement on that and then move forward with the package.
I think it's an election year. Governor Ducey has made it clear he wants to keep his pledge that he will never raise taxes during his first term. And he doesn't want Prop 301 renewal or an expansion of 301 on the ballot for whatever reason in this election year. He doesn't want to show the leadership to fight for that. What I would be concerned about if I was the traditional neighborhood public schools, we're still 83% of our kids go, by the way, and they're the ones that are taking the hit over the last decade the most. What I would be concerned about is you wait and you put this on the ballot in 2020 when you have no leverage, because if it goes down, it just evaporates. And then the Republicans, to put it on the ballot, will extract other things from K through 12, like maybe reining in bond elections that local districts rely heavily on for property taxes. That would be very favorable to two entities: charter schools that don't get any bond election money, so they wouldn't care, and it would be very favorable to big property taxpayers from the business world who would love to see their property taxes not raised in bond elections. That type of leverage, in my opinion, could further kill traditional K through 12 public schools, and I'd be very leery of that.
That's Chris Hurstam. Also here is Marcus Dell'Artino. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. Our Friday newscap continues after this short break. Good Friday. Thanks for listening to the show on 91.5 KJZZ. We're in the midst of our Friday newscap with Marcus Dell'Artino, partner at the firm First Strategic, and former member of the Board of Regents, Chris Hurstam. Guys, let's move on to CD8. We saw a couple of debates this week in the race to succeed Trent Franks. Marcus, let me turn to you, since this is a Republican-leaning district, even though the Democrats are trying to put up a strong effort here. What did you hear? Did you pay attention a lot to Wednesday's debate? How important was that? And who stood out other than Claire Van Steenwijk, of course?
I did not pay a whole lot of attention to it because, there's not a whole lot of difference in between these candidates. I hate to sort of break it down like that, but really they're all very conservative. They're very they all love Trump to death almost. So there's not a whole lot of discernment as far as a policy standpoint goes. I think when you go back and if you were to make up a voting record in between all of them, that would match up almost 100%.
The problem is the debate And because this is on a very short timetable, because it's a unique special election, there's going to be very few debates. And so the Republic's sponsorship of a debate did a tremendous disservice, in my view, in CD8. They, using their own criteria, only allowed five of the dozen Republican candidates to appear. And all five of them were retreads, in my view, names that have been around, been in office already. They already had built-in name ID, and they were all Trumpites. They were all individuals that, and what they did in this debate was try to out-embrace Donald Trump the best they could. That was the debate. It wasn't really a good discussion, in my view, of the issues. There are other people running for that seat that are not well-known names that, if you look on their websites, they differ from Trump on many different issues. These were newcomers. We're always encouraging newcomers to run, and the Republic eliminated them from the debate. So I was looking forward to hearing these other candidates, and we never got to hear them. So I've always said, with you on the show before, I've always said that if this thing ever happened with regards to Frank stepping aside, Debbie Lesko would win that seat. I see no reason to believe any different. She's the first to hit TV. She's, I think, the only woman in the race in the Republican primary, and so I think she's clearly the favorite.
Well, and most importantly, she represented Sun City, and Sun City loves her, and the turnout in Sun City is going to be pretty good in this
You're
election.
Right. Exactly.
Here's the game changer that we talk about in our office, which could happen any minute, as you all know, is if the President of the United States flies into town and endorses somebody, that's going to upend the race overnight. And none of us know if that's going to happen. But if a Trump endorsement comes in, it really shakes that race up. Nobody has a whole lot of money. They have some money, but not this isn't a $5 million race by any stretch of the imagination.
It's just that the Republic anointed five that we heard from, they're all pro-Trump. They all have some name ID, with the exception of Claire Van Steenwijk. Is that how you
Steenwijk,
say it?
Huh?
Van Steenwijk. They're all so solidly for Trump. I don't think Trump needs to endorse anybody in the primary. I think he'll wait for the general to bless the Republican.
Marcus, as you said, given the sort of lack of daylight on policy, do you think the fact that, for example, Debbie Lesko was first on the air with a TV ad makes that much of a difference in addition to what she represented in the legislature?
Well, I'll tell you what I find fascinating about this race from a consultant view is everybody's got their strength in different areas. I will tell you, Steve Montenegro's got excellent endorsements, and that brings some power with him. Phil Lovis worked for the president, presumably, at Small Business Administration and had a commercial out with a big Trump sign in the presidency, so that's a strength for him. His wife is a huge Republican fundraiser in town, so he's got raising money off those lists. That's a huge strength for him. Debbie Lesko, in addition to her hard work on some of the most complicated issues at the legislature, but represented some Sun City, worked on a lot of issues for those people, and they love her. So.
And she was big on the voucher school choice. That's Betsy right. DeVos, so she will plug into that money as well.
So it's going to be, I tell everybody, don't count any of them out because, this is going to be fun.
Okay, so do you guys give any odds, any chance for the Democratic candidates to even if we don't say win, but make a representative, maybe lose by only 8 to 10 points as opposed to 30 or 40?
If indeed it's a Democrat blue wave election, that is very possible, and that wave gets into Arizona, you're right. That's a possibility. But there's such a huge Republican registration lead that maybe the normal 20-point lead would go down to 10. It would take a tsunami to give that seat to the Democrats. I do, and I always mispronounce her name, the doctor, Dr. Haral
Tipperneni.
She's impressive. She is excellent. Because I couldn't remember her name, that's her biggest problem, is name ID. If she can get through the Democratic primary, she'll be a solid candidate for the Democrats. But boy, that Republican registration lead is enormous in CD8.
Yeah, I don't want to sugarcoat it. There is no way a Democrat is going to win that seat. And I will give you a virtual chance in almost every other race in the state of Arizona except for that congressional district. It will never happen. But I could make up a scenario for virtually every other seat in Arizona that a Democrat could win, but not that one.
Could this be one of those instances where for example, in some of the other special elections we've seen since President Trump won and took members of Congress into his administration, where even when Democrats lost, they maybe overperformed the Hillary Clinton or in that district or other candidates in that district. Does that even matter when you look at a district that is as one-sided, as Republican as this one?
It's like, who cares? I mean, I don't mean to say it like that, but the Democrats going to lose. So if they, if they want to feel better that they lost by less, that's great. But it doesn't change the dynamic. I think they've got a lot of great races to focus on, and I think they've got a lot of strengths this election cycle.
If a congressional candidate like the doctor of the Democrat was impressive and ran a strong race for a Democrat in that district, that would, in a very small way, but still, that could help the U.S. senatorial candidates, the Democrats that are running, and for other offices, statewide offices. So there could be a positive mix. So, you know, reducing that 20-point normal victory for Republicans down to 10 could have a positive impact on maybe some other races.
And here, this might give you help. A little perspective. We've been doing some studying of these elections that have taken place across the country, and what we're seeing repeatedly in these states is Republican women are not voting. It's not that they're voting for the Democrat; they're just not voting. They're just not showing
because
up.
They're upset because they don't like Trump.
To that point of studying it, but there is a phenomenon that is happening, and I think that if the trend continues, we will see that in Arizona, and that affects every statewide. And if I were the Democratic Party, I'd be doing some great recruiting for CorpComm, for instance.
Hey, guys, just a few seconds left, literally a few seconds. Republican State Party meeting tomorrow. There is some push, though it may be small, to ask Sheriff Arpaio to get out of the race. Chris, any chance he actually would get out of the race?
The only way I could ever see Arpaio getting out of the race is if there was personal communication from Donald Trump, who for some reason wanted to rally around McSally or something. If that doesn't happen, and I don't see it happening, yeah. I think his ego won't let him get out of the race.
Yeah, it's more likely that Trump calls him up and endorses him, frankly. I don't think there's any chance that he's going to get out of this race.
Marcus Dell'Artino, partner at the firm First Strategic and former legislative leader, former member of the Board of Regents, Chris Hurstom. Guys, thanks for joining us on the Newscap.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we continue with the show. You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.